Are you ready to learn more about promoting play, defending childhood, empowering caregivers? Save 10% on professional development at explorationsearlylearning.com and support the show with the coupon code OOL. Click the link in the show notes to browse upcoming trainings. Well, hello, everybody. I'm Annie Friday. Welcome back to another episode of Out of Line. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Gina Riley. Gina, please introduce yourself.
Hi. So glad to be here. My name is Dr. Gina Riley. I am a professor at CUNY Hunter College. Specifically, I direct the Adolescent Special Education and Gifted Education programs there. My research, however, is all focused on unschooling, homeschooling, self-directed learning, intrinsically motivated learning.
Awesome. Thank you very much for being here today. I was just explaining to Dr. Riley that I use her work often with our parents and different stakeholders who are curious about some pieces of self-directed education, in particular, the intrinsic motivation. I also was recently on a call with some people, a panel of people who were presenting about the kind of long-term options for people who choose unschooling and self-directed ed. And somebody brought up why it's so hard to collect research in this field. And so I thought maybe you could speak to that a little bit too, because there's not a ton of research. I know the Alliance for Self-Directed Education has a lot of your work featured, a lot of Dr. Peter Gray's work featured, a few other people. But what makes it hard to do research in this kind of field?
Sure, that's such a great question. I mean, I think part of it, right, is that unschooling is so not schooly. And so the idea of research or someone, you know, asking questions about your life is hard. I think it's always been hard in the early days of homeschooling and unschooling. People were quite shy about like the way they did things, how they did things. And so it is really hard to get participants to do research on unschooling because we as unschoolers, and I was one myself, I unschooled my son to adulthood, we're kind of guarded with regards to the ways we do things and how we do things.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to the greater point too, of like how hard it is to measure learning and unschooling. Like you said, it's so far from school. It's really a lifestyle choice. And it's almost impossible then to link what's being learned from unschooling versus what's being learned from life in an unschooling home.
I constantly think about that assessment and measurement part because I do a lot of assessment work in my work as a professor. And I'm constantly thinking, right, like unschooling is probably the most authentic you're ever going to get in terms of like authentic learning and things like that. It's really hard to measure authentic learning, right? Just like it's hard to grade authentically. And so that's a huge piece of it.
Yeah. Well, and you know I did not plan to be a homeschooler or an unschooler. I consider us both. I was an educator. I liked research. I liked statistics. I liked structure. And yet I found myself in a place where we needed something different. And I think when I first started even like having that notion in my head of like this, there is another option, right? Like, and I had it in the back of my head and maybe I'd feel brave enough to like say it out loud in certain circles or to certain people. And almost always you hear the same really common kind of tropes of homeschooling, right? Oh, the lack of socialization, they're so isolated, it's mostly religious people. And you don't often hear a lot of things to the positive. And I have to say that in one of your papers, you reference a positive point. And I think it's just such a brilliant reason that so many people, and it is such a growing field of homeschoolers and unschoolers right now. But you said one of the most impressive strengths of home education lies in the fact that in many cases, the entire process revolves around a child's intrinsic motivation to learn. Tell us more about just what intrinsic motivation is.
Sure. I've studied this my whole academic life, right? And I'm sitting in my desk and I'm sitting by my master's thesis, which I wrote in like 1999 or something like that, focused on intrinsic motivation in homeschoolers. And it was really the piece that it sort of influenced me to homeschool my own child. So when we talk about intrinsic motivation, it's about the love. It's about the passion. It's about the joy, right? In whatever you're doing. And so it's obviously opposite to extrinsic motivation, which is about the grade or the percentage number or the prize, right? It really digs deep into why we do what we do. And I fell in love with that notion of intrinsically motivated learning, of waking up every single day, loving what you do, doing what you love, having kids love what they do, and having kids do what they love. And so, like early on, I decided, oh, I want to study this for the rest of my life, right? Because that's how I want my life to look. That's how I want my child's life to look. It's how I want my family's life to look. Life is so short. We might as well be doing what we love most of the time. All of us know that intrinsic motivation doesn't happen all of the time, right? There are some things we just have to do. But what a gift it is to give a child the opportunity to be doing things that they love most of the time.
Yeah, and I think about so many of the adults I work with. I do a lot of parent educating and parent coaching now, and often adults don't have their own like connection to their intrinsic motivators. And we really have to de-school and unlearn some stuff before we can kind of relearn what it is that ignites us. And I've talked about on the show before, for people who listen, like it was a resume filler for me, right? Like the hobbies, the interests, that like it was something to add on, but I was like, what is it? Because I work all day and I come home and I watch TV until I fall asleep. Like there wasn't much in intrinsic motivation in my own life. And so the idea of it is confusing sometimes to people.
I think it's confusing to everyone, right? I think that's why, like, parents have such a hard time sometimes grasping, the homeschooling, unschooling philosophy. I think teachers do too, although teachers, I think, in their hearts want that, right? They want to see from their students that joy of learning. I work in teacher ed. I work with my teachers all the time, right? I train New York City school teachers. I know that they want to see in their kids that spark, that joy. I think it's also important to understand the reality of our lives, right? Like we work for extrinsically motivated things, our house, our the money, right? And it's hard enough to do that. And so to unlearn all of that, to unlearn the, working for something or working harder for something or working even harder for something, and then going to like, ooh, what do I love? What do I care about? What does my child love and care about? What does my teen love and care about? That is, there's a big deschooling process that goes there, and it's no one's fault. It's just the pressures of everyday life, which is highly extrinsic.
Right. Yeah. And that's, yeah, and it has to be that way. It's part of the system, the society we live in, the greater system, right? Not just the system of education. So I guess, I'm curious, you touched on this in that answer, that why does it, what is harder about finding intrinsic motivation in a conventional school setting? What makes it more challenging for teachers?
Oh, so many things, right? So,
No, that's like
so many things. So there's the structure of traditional schooling, right? It's highly structured. There is pressure to teach for the test. There is pressure to get X amount of lessons done in a day, in a week. There is the pressure to have, do everything within a 43 or a 45-minute period as you get older. And there's the pressure of managing X amount of children, right? 25 or 30 children in a classroom with, a couple of adults if you're lucky. And so there's just a lot of pressure. It's pressure from the state. It's pressure from the district. It's pressure from the principal or the administrator. It's pressure in the teacher. And so it just makes it hard. I think my teachers often see, and the most wonderful thing about working with teachers is you can see that like they're purpose is to have kids love learning. And so when they get that spark, right, they're like so excited about it, but it doesn't happen often in their classrooms or in their lives. And so I think that's the hard thing about being in school and having to have that sort of structure. I will never be the person that says school does not have a place in our society because I do think it does, right? I think that it's a choice. It's all a choice. And I think that if you are able to homeschool and unschool, that's a choice as well. And there are different ways to be able to do that, right? It doesn't have to be the realm of the two-parent family. I was a single parent that was had $5 in their pocket and unschooled. But you know, it's all a choice. And I think the more we legitimatize different choices, the better off we are, and the better off we can sort of think about how we can learn from, how we can learn from school, how we can learn from unschooling, to provide the best types of environments for our kids.
So this is not where I thought this conversation would go, but I have
Probably
to ask
not.
this. I wanna take us down a little pathway here, because choice comes up a lot, and it comes to a very political place for a lot of people. And I know there was a time in my life when I was just an obnoxiously staunch public school advocate, and how dare you send your kids somewhere else? And our public schools are never going to get the resources they need if we have all of these choices. And also, as a administrator and teacher in early childhood settings, preschool settings, people would say, now I have to choose when my kid's 5 years old, what's going to be better? Is the Montessori school going to be better? Is the, conventional school going to... And it's really hard to know your kid that well when they're 5 years old, because especially if they've been in childcare or preschool, you don't get to see them in those settings. And so I guess, where am I going with this? Just kind of like, how is
I
that choice?
probably,
Like, yeah.
yeah, it's such a great, like, this is actually the first podcast that's ever asked this, and I'm so excited about, right? So it's actually a great question because I never see it. So funny when I said that statement, right? Like all of a sudden the school choice thing came. I am not a political person. And so I've never seen the notion of choice as political, right? I've always seen the notion of choice as part of like my research in freedom and autonomy. Right. Like, and I don't see that as political at all. It's literally just like we have to, as parents and as, you know, and as kids and teens, because kids and teens make their own decisions too, we have to learn to be good decision makers. And there are like all of these choices in the world. And we kind of have to learn to make the best choice for us. And so for me, when we talk about choice, right, it's literally just about freedom and autonomy. Some people have a hard time. I do a lot of work on like decision making. I do a lot of work on supported decision making, which is an alternative to guardianship for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And people have a hard time seeing like, oh, where does like the homeschooling and unschooling fit in with this like whole decision making thing that you're doing? And my answer is always, oh, it's just for me about freedom and choice, right? There's nothing else.
And it may not feel political to you, but that does come down, right? Like, because it's all about our humanity and how we get to express it and present it to the world. And freedom of choice is such an important part of the human experience, and feeling liberated or feeling oppressed or feeling like you have options. Going back a little bit towards intrinsic motivation, is self-determination theory different? Is self-determination and intrinsic motivation, are they different things? Are they two ways of saying the same thing?
Edward Deci and Richard Ryan are the best people on the planet, right? In my head. They are the people that have created really the definition of self-determination, the theory of self-determination. And all self-determination theory does, and this is something, again, that I've studied for like 25 years, and now it's becoming super popular, which I'm so happy about. But I always think it's interesting, right? Like self-determination theory itself defines intrinsic motivation. So that's all it does. It just defines intrinsic motivation. It talks about how it's different from extrinsic motivation. And then it talks about like the different levels that you can have of intrinsic motivation, because it's not like you're either intrinsically motivated or extrinsically motivated, right? So there's a lot to self-determination theory. There's like 700 page books on it.
And
I
can
love,
you define it for us in 20 minutes or
yeah,
less?
right. I mean, all it does is define the notion of intrinsic motivation, right? Like that's all it does. But it's so powerful. It also, within self-determination theory, has this sub-theory of cognitive evaluation theory. And it's a fancy name, but all it is it answers the question like, how do I facilitate intrinsic motivation in my kids? Or how do I facilitate intrinsic motivation in myself? And, you know, in terms of cognitive evaluation theory, there's three things that really feed into the facilitation of intrinsic motivation. And the first thing is having students and having ourselves have a sense of competence, right? Knowing who we are, having confidence in ourselves, knowing our strengths. And then the second part is having a sense of autonomy. Again, here's where that freedom and choice line comes in, right? Knowing that we are humans with all of the choices in the world. And then having a sense of relatedness, having one person that believes in us no matter what, believes in us whether we make them happy or not, whether we make good decisions or not, right? You give kids competence, autonomy, and relatedness, and then you give them the path to intrinsic motivation. That's why I love this so much.
And you can do you, those three things can come in so many forms and in so many spaces and environments, right? Like it's not
Everywhere.
absent from school, even though
Nope.
it may be harder to access intrinsic motivation because of time limits, because of space limits, because of resource limits. Like you mentioned, 25 or 30 students, hopefully two teachers or two adults in the room. And I know the school we were at, there was never two adults in the room. Like if you're talking 25 to 30 kindergartners, which is our pretty average. It fluctuated those first few months of school. Some days it was like, we have 25 and it's capped at this. And then the next day they'd be like, we just get four more enroll. And it's one teacher. You're talking kindergarten. So you've got older 4-year-olds up to through 6-year-olds. And those levels also go like all over the place. So how are you know, you're just so limited in your ability to help those kids find what's going to motivate them. And so then that's where those constraints come on, like you mentioned, the principal, the district that, goes from there. But it's
I mean,
competency, autonomy, and relatedness.
yeah, and that theory and that sub theory, it works everywhere, right? It works in school, out of school. It works in healthcare. It works in medicine. It works in the workplace. It's not like these things are constrained to homeschooling or the self-directed learning environment, right? Everyone has access to these.
And young people and old people alike, is there a difference between, the age of when you get to experience these things?
I mean, I think, it's so funny because I'm entering an age where I start thinking about like my old age, right? And I'm thinking about, oh my gosh, like, do you have more freedom or less freedom? And when you think of like interviews with people who are older, you always hear them say, like, I feel like I can say whatever I want now. I feel like I have that, the wisdom that leads to, my gosh, like this life is so precious, and let's do everything we can that we love. So yeah, I mean, I think maybe the little kids and the older people, they know best, and maybe we just get all stuck in the middle somehow.
Bookending life, yeah.
Yeah.
I also think so those three words are really important and easy to identify. I think any educator in particular, parent, anyone working with young people can have their own relationship to those three words: competence, autonomy, and relatedness, right? And I think of the work of Dr. Ross Green and Kids Do Well When They Can, coming back to competence. And so often when we see challenging behaviors, we want to change the behavior. We want to change the child when all they're doing is lagging a skill, right? Like it's just
And
they're
does it
lacking the
really?
competence.
Yeah. And does it really matter in the end, right? I often think like, what is the expectation? Why do some behaviors really bother us and others don't? Why does it bother us when kids don't read whatever on time is, right? Or and it bothers us because it bothers us, right? There's
Oh my
no,
gosh. I have a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old right now.
Yeah.
And my 9-year-old was still in the school system and when he learned to read, and my 7-year-old was in the school system But he was always a really numbers oriented young guy. And so all of a sudden letters were being thrown at him, and he wanted to decode them similar to the numbers he was working with. But he just like he didn't ha he wasn't interested in it, right? And then we left the system, and I've spent I do this. I know it's okay. I logically I've told so many other parents like it's okay. And yet I still have these moments of panic this year of like, is he ever going to read? And then there is this like, it's a very linear societal expectation of like, so he's in second grade and not reading. And then like just this weekend alone, actually, like I just pulled out a few things and was like, let's see where he's at. Like we do these kind of check-ins, like not forcing it, always through connection. And it was like, it clicked and he wanted to go and he like flew away with it, right? And I'm like, he's going to be reading in a week now. And all this time, and I have not spent too much time dwelling in the worry moments, but we can get there with whatever it is, whether it's, I mean, reading's a really obvious one for all of us because it's really obvious when a kid isn't reading by the time they're supposed to, in quotes, be reading. Other things are a little harder to prove because people just have less like knowledge of, oh, you're in third grade, you have to know long division by now or whatever it is. But it's hard even for those of us who know better to remind ourselves that it's okay.
I think I spent 16 years in worry, right? Myself, I really do. I think I did. It comes up often. So my son had really awful handwriting, like really awful, right? Where if you were a public school teacher and you would to see his handwriting at 13, you would really worry. And I'm a teacher of teachers, right? So, right? If anyone got
You
that
know
stuck
when they're
in their
worrying.
head, I know when to worry. So my son is 28 years old. He is an editor at a publishing company, and all he does is write and edit other people's work, right? I should not have worried about that handwriting. There was no reason to. Again, I think sometimes we get so stuck in like societal, right? And I realized I didn't even notice the handwriting until someone said something,
Of course,
right? It's
right?
often like someone says something and then you're like, oh, or you read something and then you're like, oh, right. And there is, you know, we don't have to be stuck on timelines, right? Like we've read research on traditionally school kids learning to read. We've read research on kids who haven't gone to school learning to read, right? And really the timeline is the timeline that's set. And that's why people worry about it, right? Traditional school is most popular. It sets a timeline. This is why we worry. I did an article on unschooled students learning to read, and the range was from 4 to 13, I think. And the only person that worried were the parents, right? It wasn't really the kids, but the kids felt the parents' worry.
Sure, absolutely. And I think when we what we're worried about is that we're leaving them unconnected, disconnected to some really important aspect of society, right? And I think I don't know if I could wait till 13. I know of parents and families who have done that, and I'm like always like, oh, I'm just like in awe with them because I think that my panic would have taken over by then. But and then you hear the stories of kids who are in the school system who make it to high school not being able to read, or who graduate not being able to read. Like, I mean, I live in Michigan. We've got some schools that...
As
and
listen, as
it's
someone who is in, I'm in schools all the time. I'm in schools all the time. Right. I am not surprised when I see a junior high schooler not read. I am not surprised when I see a ninth grader not read. And we're not all blaming it on COVID, right? It's not about the learning loss.
Well, and part of it, you mentioned intrinsic motivation earlier and talking about like waking up wanting to do what you love. And I think that's another aspect that makes it really tricky is that it's not linear, right? Like this is not a linear form of learning. And so some days you're going to wake up and not feel intrinsically motivated to do anything. And especially when they're young people and we're so used to, we have an idea of what they're supposed to be doing in their head, in my head. It can be hard to just lean into that, like, okay, he's not going to do anything today, and that's okay. And, you know, sometimes I'll be guilty of saying it at my home, sometimes in the ALC setting, where I'll just be like, you guys are doing nothing today. And luckily, my 7-year-old is like one of those wise people, and he's like, "Mom, it's really impossible to do nothing because I'm sitting here, I'm breathing, I'm thinking." And he starts listing all the things he's actually doing. And I'm like, "You're right." And I have no idea what's going on in your head or your body today. So I'll back away, and you know, I have a moment of repair of like, "Sorry, you're right. I'm learning still to not say that."
Yeah, it's, I have a phrase, it's like there's no such thing as lazy. And I really strongly believe that, right? Creative people will always know that when they are feeling most like they have to rest or most like they have to do nothing, that there is an idea stewing, that there is creativity stewing, and that's most times when people do their best work after a period of rest or after a period of rejuvenation, right? Like we come back from vacation and we're all of a sudden motivated to do stuff. That's sort of a natural process, right? I always think like if someone's being lazy or if someone is resting too much, then it really just means that their best work is ahead of them.
Yeah. And I think the relatedness and that connected piece, like that's also where
Sure.
you like.
Unless there's something, right? Unless, like, I'm thinking of like if you have an individual who's depressed, right? That might be a sign of something. But if you have a student that's not depressed, that's not showing signs of depression, that you have a relationship with, that you know this kid. And they are resting or they're on the couch like reading or that's not being lazy. That's creativity.
Well, and I have to ask you, and we can end on this because the honestly, one of the most comforting. So I found you and or I think I'd seen your work prior, but I got to see you speak a couple times last year through the Alliance for Self-Directed Education. And one of the stories I think was the most powerful, like moment of like comfort and like just relax. It's all going to work out. It's all working out. Was your year of Wii golf? Would you be willing to talk a little bit about
And there were other years, right?
that?
So my teenage self literally spent an entire year playing Wii golf, right? And like trying to win at this game. So it was like the Wii golf, and I think it was Wii bowling probably at the same time. And that literally is all he did for the entire year. And I am freaking out in my head, right? I am like legit freaking out in my head. In the it's so funny because we talk about as an adult, he talks about his unschooling experience so beautifully. Like I'm so glad I spent a year playing Wii golf, right? Because adulting is hard, right? But also, like he learned, and I think that's so cool. Like he was able to visualize yardages, right? Still to this day, he can be like, "Oh, that's 300 yards away," and I'm just like, I mean, I would not know that, right? And he'll laugh and he'll say, "It was my years of Wii golf when you would," right? And they'd say, "Like that's 300 yards away." Yeah, it was a really nerve-wracking year, and then everything is okay, right? Like he is probably the best human on the earth, and I'm not saying it because I'm his mom, right? Because other people have said it too, but he's just a really good human. He's got a master's degree. He has like a 9-to-5 job. He's a better like money person than I am, right? He can he can juggle finances and all of those things as an adult that you have to juggle. That year of Wii golf was really, a year of if I guess for him it was a year of like, I'm a teenager. I don't know what I'm going to do next. And I really need to think about it. Right. And golf and bowling was a great distraction. And it taught him yardages and everything else that it taught him. And I'm sure there's other skills in there. But yeah, made me nervous as heck and
Yeah.
probably, not to worry.
And I think all parents, whether your kids are in school or not, can relate to that on some level because there's this moment of like, are they ever going to do anything else? Or, but teenagers in particular, and I find it really fascinating to hear from grown unschoolers on this topic, like how much free time they had as teenagers, because teenagers really need that space to just kind of tinker and play. And they don't play, you know, the play invitations aren't the same as when they were young kids. And so I think that's really cool.
And you're deciding who you are, right? Like you're trying to find your place in the world. And I think to have that time and space to find out who you are, to really like figure out what's going on in your body and your space in this world. I mean, it's so important and probably so healing.
Yeah, I would imagine. I have one more quote, and I will link this paper. I don't have the title of it, but it's one on of yours on intrinsic motivation. And you said stakeholders within the realm of education should take note, as intrinsically motivated, self-directed learning truly seems to be the future of education itself. Any like closing thoughts around that, maybe?
I still love that. I think that's the last page of my book, Unschooling, Exploring, Learning Beyond the Classroom. And I still love that because I think that we see, right? Like that book was written prior to COVID. Now, post-COVID, we see all these parents, right, thinking about learning options for their kids that are different and more based in intrinsic motivation. I think if anything, through COVID, we got a sense of what was important to us, what we wanted, right? Any real health emergency will do that. You begin to think about how you want to live life and how you want your family to live life. So I'm really proud to say that, like, I love that now, parents have all these options. Homeschooling is no longer this scary word, right? Nor is unschooling, and that we're working towards sort of a more intrinsically motivated educational experience for everyone. So that makes me really, really happy.
Yeah, I agree. Gina, Dr. Riley, tell us where to find you more of your stuff, your research, your book. Where can we find more of you?
Sure. It's so funny because I don't do social media that often, but I'm Professor G Riley on Twitter. I have a website. It's ginarileyphd.com. I'm the Unschooled Professor on Instagram. And I do a lot of like ResearchGate stuff. So if you go on ResearchGate and you look at my profile, you could probably find all of the research there in full text. So it's always fun to dig deep in there.
Awesome. And say the name of your book one more time.
Sure. So the two books, it's the first one was Unschooling, Exploring Learning Beyond the Classroom. And that was published by Palgrave Macmillan. That's an academic book on unschooling. And then there is the more probably accessible Homeschooling Starter Guide. And I'm really proud to say it was like a lot of people found that at Five Below, but it's also found at like Amazon and Barnes and Nobles and all your local bookstores.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming and sharing. And I just appreciate all of your work so much.
Thank you so much. Such a joy. This was so great. Thank you.
Oh, good. Well, take care. And everybody else, thank you for listening.
It's time to become a member of Playvolution HQ and Explorations Early Learning. There's a free option and three paid patron level options. All come with free stuff and ongoing automatic training and merch discounts. For as little as a dollar a month, you can become a patron. That supports our work and you get premium stuff like early access to fresh podcast episodes. Go to explorationsearlylearning.com/membership or click the link in this episode's description to learn more. All the cool listeners are doing it.
This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.
Oh.